episode of Atomic Heroes. This is your host, James Bond. Tonight I have a special guest. I got very fortunate just working on his car. and I just keep finding how interesting this guy is. And I asked him to come on my show because he just looks like a guy that's been a part of this, you know, Asian American community in the Bay Area. And he's like a mouthful of words. He's an entrepreneur. He's a broker. And, you know, like when I look at him, it's like, dude, this guy's a bodybuilder. And then, you know, I hear a couple of stories and he's like, he was on American Ninja Warrior. This guy's an all around hero.
Thanks. I hope I can actually live up to all that.
I have Brian Benikid. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, James. My pleasure.
So, yeah, you know, like I've been trying to catch up and I've always wanted to hear your story about being on the American Ninja Warrior. Like, didn't that thing start back in like 2010? Like, I remember like watching it and like astonished because it brought me so much nostalgia of like American Gladiator. But I was like, this is so much better, you know, because it's like we can do stuff.
Oh, no, no. I when I first started watching American Ninja Warrior, it was on the Sci-Fi channel or what was that? And they were at the time. G4. And G4 became the Sci-Fi channel. And I remember just watching excerpts or the series that they brought over from Japan and on G4 and just, you know, just wishing that that show was, you know, here. And, you know, I was a big fan of it even before it became American Ninja Warrior. And then, you know, even became more of a fan when they imported the franchise over and it became American Ninja Warrior. Yeah. So it was always, I was a just avid watcher of it. And so, you know, when the opportunity came about that I might actually be able to be on the show, I jumped at it, you know, and, went at it mad and started training.
I mean, like, what is it like when you kind of hear this and you're like, okay, I'm gonna start training. Like, where do you begin? You're just like, okay, I'm gonna start running.
So that's a great question. So by the time I had my first opportunity to get into the show and actually start training for it, I was like 39 years old. Mm-hmm. So there's a picture I like to keep on my Facebook. It's my first time on American Gladiator in 2015. It was a shot from Orlando, and I was 40 at the time. And so, like, you know, when you ask like what got you into that, well, I mean, it was a number of things. I just came through the big Great Recession, and I was already a seasoned broker, entrepreneur, real estate developer, and thankfully like, I got through it. But you know, and kept everything intact. But I took my serious like beatings financially during that time, regardless, you know, and understood full and well what it meant to have to personally guarantee a construction loan or a huge loan. Regardless, I was stressed out, got a little fat. You know, I'm not a tall guy, so when you gain a little bit of weight,
I'm a big guy.
No, you know what? But I don't know what it was like for you, but I grew up in a Filipino family, and you know, I've heard the stories about Tiger moms and Chinese moms. Mm-hmm. And Filipino moms are like, "You're still fat," you know, like they're like fun of you, you know, like, "But you're fat. What's wrong with you?" Right? And so you grow up in a family of brothers, right?
Yes.
Filipino brothers who are all trained this way, and so by the time I was like 38, I had gained a bunch of weight, and so I took this picture with my brothers who were like, we're all in their prime, and they're younger brothers, right? Like one's boxing, one's doing jujitsu. The other guy, you know, he's just training with his personal trainer here in Hercules, of all things. And we all go to the water slides with our kids, and we take this group picture, and they totally body shame me, and I'm just like, my brother who works with me in the office, he's one of my broker associates, you know, he's been with me for like over like 15 years now. He says, "Hey, you got to come and, you know, check out my personal trainer. You know, his name is Christian here in Hercules." So I did. I started like training with him, and like next thing you know, I'm dropping weight and I'm seeing my, you know, my body again. And he's like, "You know, you should do a men's physique competition." Right. So I was like, okay, yeah, why not? You know, I've always wanted to do that. And what a better way to, you know, start that goal. So I go in there that first year. And now this was in 2012 by the time I got into my first men's physique show. Wow. And so, you know, I had done the men's physique and learned how to eat right and train and really control like body weight and all this kind of stuff, which I did. You know, it's funny thing is I'd always gone to the gym in my, you know, since my, you know, teens and mid 20s and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand nutrition, and he taught all this stuff about nutrition. And next thing you know, I know how to control my body fat just from like eating six times a day and, you know, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing, I turned men's physique training into like a lifestyle, right? Because like, you know, I could fit into suits I didn't fit in before and all this kind of stuff. And so by right about this time, you know, I'm watching the show. I'm a huge fan of American Ninja Warrior. And I'm like, I'm going to submit my video. And I'm like, dude, I'm pushing 40 and I'm going to do it. So that was in 2015. You know, I submitted it in like December of 2014. And then in January of 2015, they called me up and said, hey, we like your video. You know, we like your story. And could you do the show? And so the funny thing is I get this call, like, so I submitted the video in December of 2014, and I had been training for a local competition here in Concord, and I got injured and I tore my left Achilles tendon. And the funny, it was crazy. So it happens in December 2014. I'm supposed to be in Hong Kong on business like on Monday. And so I'm like, screw this. I grabbed my, I had a boot, you know, those ankle bracelets from a prior injury, and I strap it on, jump onto the plane, and I'm off to Hong Kong, and I'm like running around in crutches in Hong Kong in December of 2014, doing business, you know, real estate business, right? You know, I'm working with Chinese investors, buying and investing in apartments and commercial real estate in California.
Wow.
I fly back to, you know, to the States, January of 2015. Mm-hmm. And I got this call and I'm so excited. And they're like, hey, can you show up in March? And like, by this time I had gone to the doctor, the doctor's like, you know, had operated on my leg and I was in a cast.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor's like, you're going to be in this cast for at least 6 months. And so I'm on the phone with the guys at American Ninja Warrior. And I'm like,
sure.
Can we push that out as far back as what's the latest show you guys have? So they were like, okay, I mean, can you fly out to Orlando? It's going to be in May.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'll take that slot. So that, you know, from January to like April, I'm training with my personal trainer in a cast, and I have pictures of all this, there's videos, and
wow.
And I'm just going at it. And then the month before, you know, like I'm seeing my doctor who actually reattached my tendon, and he's like, dude, you're crazy. You know, you're one of these extreme guys. And I'm like, I know, like, you only live once, you know, blah, 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 you know, plenty of sleep when I die. And so the cast comes off, you know, and I have that first scene, you know, like in May of 2015, it's like 3 a.m. in the morning. I'm out there with my family, a bunch of people from my office at the Universal Studios, Orlando, Florida. And I mean, I learned so much from combining men's physique and doing the Ninja Warrior training stuff, which is like a combination of parkour and gymnastics and just, you know, like crazy badass shit, like, you know, like hanging from the fingertips and stuff.
Yeah, and well, that's what I remembered. I mean, like, I mean, partially a good chunk of the first two rounds were always, there wasn't really a time, you just had to finish the course.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's like, and it's a lot of upper body right in the beginning, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've seen people slip and oh my God, it must have been nerve wracking because you got, I mean, did you get to try it a few times first or you know, you walk out and the lights are just in your eyes?
Yeah, no, you don't get to try it out. I mean, it was one of these things like for me, right? You know, I love like fantasy superheroes and I was like, okay, you know, like the whole James Bond, you know, like spy thing, you know, and I'm like, I'm 40 and I'm like, okay, I'm never going to have this chance again, you know, blah, blah, blah. I better do it. So I'm just going to give it my all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like when I, that's how I train, that's how I work. And, you know, when I did that, it just brought out another side of me and it kind of like reinvigorated a whole, you know, like the younger side of me back. And after that, I was like, hook, I don't want to give this up, you know, even if I'm not on the show. But But because of that, you know, I was able to be on the show, invited back in first time was in 2015, and then I did it again in 2016, this time at the LA Universal Studios. And then the third time was 2017. And that was the last time I had done it, because at the last show, I was determined to get some airtime. And so what I mean by that is, like, what a lot of people don't know is there's like 150, 250 people on that first night doing this course. Mm-hmm. And then, they're videoing all of us, but then they're chopping it up and they're editing it for TV so that, you know, like, the people that they think are most interesting are going to get airtime. So I'm like, all right, let me do an iron cross, you know, for the show. And I'm doing this in 2017.
Oh.
And as I'm holding it, my bicep rips.
Oh.
And so I was like, oh my God, that's so crazy. And that was like 2017. And there's the scar.
Oh, okay.
What they did is, I mean, the bicep's back, and I'm back to doing pull-ups and doing, you know, like, all the crazy stuff. But I go to the show, it rips, and then, you know, the doctor tells me, you know, oh, we have to reattach it.
Okay.
Or operate, or we can, you know, teach you how to operate with like 25% of your arm strength. So I'm like, no, cut me open, do what you need to do.
Okay.
So he attaches it, and, you know, and I went on, rehabilitated it, and just kept training. I haven't had a chance to do the show because, like, other parts of, like, my world, my real estate career, you know, developing,
started
taking off. And then right about that time, I, you know, started looking at producing content for movies and things like that. And, you know,
which that's actually some of the other stuff I wanted to get into. But real quick, I do want to ask, so how long was the rehab on the bicep at that point? Because, I mean, you know, they had to reattach it. So after that, it was like, what, another 6 months or?
No. So you're going to laugh. Mm. You're going to really laugh. So when the bicep, it wasn't the bicep muscle that tore, it was the tendon. Mm-hmm. And so when it ripped, the thing dropped. And I didn't even feel any pain. It wasn't painful at all. It just, my, you know, like, I just couldn't even lift up my iPad. It was like, I'd have to strain to lift up my iPad, right? Mm. And so when the doctor reattached it, what they did is they cut the cartilage off, because that was what ripped. And so it was the old frayed cartilage, and then they reattached the strong cartilage and it just rejoined. So, like, literally, I have this cast on for a month. Mm. And then after the cast goes off, and then you start training and you're doing push-ups and doing the other things. And probably, like, within 3 months after that, I was back to doing 50 pull-ups and, you know, straight, and it was fine. But the funny thing is I was in an arm cast like this for the whole time.
Oh, okay. So, like, at a 90 degree, like, shoulder level.
And at the time this was happening, my wife decides to get me to do ballroom dancing. And so
there's nothing wrong in that. I've loved it for years. I'm not gonna deny that, fans.
in fact, so again, I have pictures of this stuff. This was in like 2017. Mm-hmm. I'm back. It was like from LA, and I'm like, honey, I injured myself again. And we were training for a ballroom competition, you know, like a few months before. Like, my wife says, okay, if you're gonna do Ninja Warrior, you gotta do something I like. So we were training for a ballroom competition, you know, foxtrot, tango, cha-cha, the whole night. And I come back, you know, in this cast. Mm-hmm. And so the funny thing is, it trained me to hold the
tango blade
pose.
Oh, okay.
So, like, by the time the cast came off and we do our first show in Vegas, you know, like, it's all very routine. You know, we win our, like, our first amateur competition, and my wife's, like, really happy. our dance instructors are like, well, you know what? That was the best thing that could have happened, because you were just trained to keep your pose. it was crazy.
But that's very healthy in any relationship, because you want your partner to. I love ballroom dancing. It's hard since pandemic's happened. You can't really, you know, come 6 foot close to anybody that.
Well, you know, you watch shows like Dancing with the Stars, and, you know, like, you know, kind of stuff you watch with your wife, right? Because those are her dramas. You know, like he's like, okay, you know, I supported you in your thing. We got to do this. So we got these really cool dance instructors. It was a married couple pair, and they would teach their students to go through their different competitions. And so we did that. And you know, again, I got that kind of took over for a bit because I had to like let the arm come back. And by the time 2017 was over, I'm to 2018. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm back to doing some more real estate oriented stuff. And then by talking about producing a movie, which then we ended up doing in 2019 on another partnership deal with some other associates of mine.
So what when you decided to do this movie, let's kind of talk about that real quick. It was just another venture at this chapter in your life where you're like, okay, I want to try this movie out. I'm playing. What kind of role was this?
No. So I didn't act in the movie.
Okay.
I strictly produced it. You know?
Okay.
But so a little bit of background on how that happened, right? Mm-hmm. I have one long-term associate of 20 years. He's my CPA. You know, to call him just CPA doesn't do him justice because he's primarily the auditor for mortgage bankers and other high net worth individuals in the Bay Area who are looking for, you know, important stuff, high level stuff. So he has access to these types of clients. You know, this guy raises a little, what do we call a film fund? And it's private capital, just people putting capital into investing with him. And he uses this fund, which grows to about $30 million, to buy licensing rights for movies here in the States that he turns around and licenses in Latin America, HBO Latin America, Netflix Latin America. So this gig goes on, goes pretty well for a while. You know, we're just getting a good return. He's just trading paper, literally just moving licenses and wheeling and dealing. So right about 2018, he's like, you know, this is pretty good. We should produce a movie from scratch. And I'm like, seriously, come on, man. What kind of nonsense is that? So I'm like, look, I have another buddy who's a hedge fund manager, and he's talking this kind of nonsense too. But you know, you got to meet him. He manages Hollywood money and Bollywood money. He's a real good guy. I've known him for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He's out of Vegas, so I connect us all up on a Zoom call, right? In fact, my CPA comes down to my office in Pinole, and we're talking about this development that I'm doing, a real estate development. And I'm, you know, as a side thought, he's like, you know, what about this? You know, what are your thoughts about producing a movie? Now, I'm kind of talking about it in broad strokes about producing a movie, but mm-hmm. there's a lot that goes into it. If you're a real movie producer, what I found is that you're a business person at heart. You're an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
A lot of the things that it takes to produce a movie are things that an entrepreneur would find second nature. And since I'm kind of a serial entrepreneur where, you know, you're running the business, you're looking at budgets, you're looking at employees, you're looking at staff. When I actually started looking into the whole notion of doing such a thing, I was like, this isn't too far off from what I already do. It's just instead of having a finished product where you have a completed, newly built building, mm-hmm. you have a movie, an intellectual property. So anyways, I introduce my buddy Jeff to my buddy Ron, who's a hedge fund manager who manages Hollywood money and Bollywood money, right? And now, although he's a stockbroker, his passion is films. This guy loves like Oscar bait material type of films. These are films I would not normally watch. I mean, I love Marvel, DC, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, all that kind of stuff, right? And, you know, Rod is a film buff, and this guy's got like $400,000 worth of high-end camera equipment to produce movies. So anyways, the three of us start talking, and, you know, the more we talk about it, and, you know, we're business people, the more realistic it starts to be. And so he's like, you know, I know of a gal in the Bay Area, her name is Alana Brown. And I read her script called Trees of Peace, and I was blown away. This gal's writing is amazing. The story is very good. You guys got to read it, and I want you guys to meet her. In fact, he flies down from Vegas, We all get together and we meet with this gal in Walnut Creek. And this is like in July of 2019.
Wow.
We meet with her over dinner, her and her husband, and we're talking about this movie that she had written, this script. Mm-hmm. It's not a movie. This script that she had written like 7 years ago. So now it's 2021. So it would have been like 10 years ago now. In 2019, it was 7 years ago, right? So 9 or 10 years ago. Anyways.
It's such a quick bleep during this pandemic, you know? Everybody's reliving that year.
Yeah, it's crazy. So in 2019, it had been like, she started writing the script, and she literally had been trying to produce this or get this film made. She was listed with one of the top agencies in Hollywood, UTA, this gal's writing is so good that one of her scripts is on what's called Hollywood's blacklist. And that's a good thing, actually. It's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's the top like 20 or top 50 scripts that people have voted as a great script that has not been yet made into a movie.
Mm.
So, you know, apparently at one time, Ben Affleck was attached to this script that he was gonna back it and get the movie made. But for whatever reason, it never got made. And so we started dissecting this script assembling a budget as to what it would take to make it. We start figuring out like, well, what could we do so we don't lose our money and look like a bunch of idiots, you know? You know, like who thought they could go produce a movie, right? So, you know, we huddle together, come up with a business plan, and then we start negotiating by like August, and by like the end of August, we have a contract written up with this gal, and mm-hmm. We fund the budget. You know, we figure out what the budget's gonna be, and mm-hmm. I get the money for it. So by this point, we find the studios, we get the line producers, and we have a full-on Hollywood set in Burbank.
Wow.
Filming by October 6th of 2019. And what a lot of people don't realize is like movies like this, they can be shot out, like all the principal photography done in like 20 days or like 60 days or 30 days, right? A lot of them, it doesn't take 3 or 4 years to make a movie.
No, as long as you have a good storyboard where everything's kind of planned out beforehand, you set out to do these things versus filming a scene and then coming back and re-editing. And that's just more time and hour manpower wasted, I think.
Yeah, totally. And so we shot it out in 20 days in a sound stage in Burbank and had all the footage you needed. We finished November 6, 2019, and we're off to post-production. Now, I don't know much about post-production because I wasn't there, you know, like the filming, the contracts negotiation, the being on set, watching the director go, dealing with injuries, dealing with workman's comp, dealing with claims and stuff like that. I was there during that whole time, you know, and it was interesting, right? I mean, at first I was just supposed to be what's called an executive producer raising money. But since I had raised the money, put the money in there, and then I was there on set watching things go wrong, I'm like, okay, I need to jump in and start helping with this stuff. Uh-huh. So, you know, we got it done. We overcame like potential lawsuits, you know, injuries on set.
Well, that's got to be crazy because, you know, it's like, yeah, no one ever foresees a lot of these, the mishaps that happen in the blooper sections of the movies, right?
Yeah. Well, no, like, that's the thing, though, is that, and this is why I keep going back to, like, the entrepreneurial experience, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you're running your own business, things go wrong all the time. And, like, you just need to, like, deal with it, you know, fix the problem. And that's what a lot of this turned out to be. So, you know, it's almost like you need to let the director do her thing and insulate her from all these problems going around. I mean, like the caterer quit, you know, the nutritionist quit. Cause like we have to train, a funny story, like these girls, the story, right? It's about four women during the Rwandan genocide hiding out in the basement. So as the time progresses, they lose a lot of weight and they become more and more emaciated looking. So we didn't want to just deal with like, you know, prosthetics and make it look bad. So we I deployed a lot of what I learned in bodybuilding and like Ninja Warrior in like, you know, diet to help these girls regulate their body weight to the point where on the screen, they looked like they were emaciated. My partner, Ron, his wife, I met them at a bodybuilding competition. I was doing men's physique and his wife was doing a bikini competition. So Michelle and I, we helped them, you know, eat right because the nutritionist quit. So it's little things like that, right? When things go wrong, you just got to go fix it. You got to jump in. And so I found myself drawing on all these experiences from all these other businesses that I had in the past to like actually get this thing done and not, you know, get stuck in developmental hell, as they call it in Hollywood, or, you know, just a movie that never makes the light of day because you just can't get the scenes done. So we finished the movie November 6th. It's off to post-production. So the editors go to work. Now, my partner, Ron, I mean, this movie wouldn't have been done without him. He was the guy that was really there. In fact, this guy was like an amazing negotiator, like with Sony and the cameras that we used and all this kind of stuff. And so like he actually got us this top-notch editor who'd worked on a lot of big name movies to do our editing. Mm-hmm. And he was able to call in favors and get like, you know, Chris Jenkins, who's this Oscar winning, you know, sound editor and musician who does a lot of the scoring for movies to consult on our movie. So it was just bringing these things together was just really amazing. And so we ended up with a finished movie by March of 2020. And we submit this movie to Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival. And then of course, 2 weeks later, as we all know, we were in lockdown.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? It's been literally a year now.
Yeah, it's literally a year. So we were supposed to premiere. We got deferred, we got delayed. So we actually like took the time to kind of rework the movie a little bit more, make the movie a little bit tighter. And at the end result, we had this even more amazing movie with an amazing story and amazing actresses and amazing performances from these gals. The movie is called Trees of Peace. And it's not a kind of movie I would normally watch, but it's the true events of four women during the Rwandan genocide. So you got a Hutsi and a Tutsi, and you have a white woman. It's mm-hmm. In fact, there's only one white woman in this entire movie. It's an all entire African-American, well, not African-American, African cast. In fact, one of our actresses, Ilian, she was 12 years old when the Rwandan genocide took place. Mm. So she lived through that genocide when she was 12, and she was one of our lead actresses in the movie. She's an actress from Paris. And we finished it, and then when things started to reopen in 2020, we started resubmitting it to film festivals. We signed our contract with the agent, and we started shopping it. And you know, he said, like, look, let's take our time and release this movie in 2021. So we did that. And so we've been getting a lot of accolades from different festivals. And we decided ultimately to premiere at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, which we're gonna do.
And this March is premiering 31st. Soon, March, yeah, 31st.
March 31st, all right. To April 8th. And then, you know, there's a number of other film festivals that we're going to, and we'll see how this goes. And then of course, all that is to help generate not only the buzz, but make it more saleable, right? Because again, this is, even though we're dealing with a lot of creative stuff, anytime you're producing anything creative, you have to look at the business angle, like why are you doing this? How are you gonna protect your money? How are you gonna get your money back and actually make a profit to make all this craziness worthwhile, right?
And well, it's important to have this the product, you know, and you got to make sure that you are keeping that intellectual property safe, because you know you don't want to be bleeding from, you know, random merchandise where someone else is making random prints or something and making off of you. It's important. I'm glad, you know, because it's like it's a huge facet of like of a big team that's, you know, doing all these little intricate things to keep, you know, a movie or a play or anything when you guys do these types of shows or movies and stuff like that, just because it's, there's so much development that goes into this. I'm amazed that, you know, it's like, yeah, it's, That's going to be a huge transition. I wanted to ask, like, if you're trying to do a diet, is it like a little bit before for the actors? Do they do it a little bit beforehand, before they start on the scene, because they need to wither away a little bit over the 20 days? Because that's pretty fast, right? Or
yeah, no, that's a very good question. So I mean, it really depends on the role you're playing. Like the same diet I'm describing can be modulated so that you're preparing, you know, like for a superhero role, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is a similar type of training regimen that
Heath Ledger? No, not Hugh Jackman. He got ripped in the last one versus, you know, when he first started.
Yeah, no, he exactly. If you look at his progression through time, the guy looks even more amazing now.
He's more jacked.
When I was in my 20s, I thought, let me just like, it's all about just like, you know, really, really like pushing as much a heavy weight as possible. And diet was like a very secondary thing, but actually the nutrition part is the actually 70% to 80% of looking like that. So whether you're going to get ripped for a superhero role or you're going to drop your weight down gradually, like you're saying, so you have a more emaciated look.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all about, you know, calorie control, you know, hydrating up, hydrating down. It's the amount of water you drink to precise measurements. So, you know, that's what was deployed in that particular case for these gals who did the show.
No, I mean, even through my years of like going back in the day of going to the gym, pushing lots of weight and dropping some weight here and there, yeah, it is a huge factor of like what you eat and how much, you know, you try to kind of moderate what you eat. I had a few conversations with a few friends where, you know, they don't eat. They kind of just, a few chews and it's swallowed through and then they're done. and you're still eating your dinner and still having a conversation with them. You're like, wow, you guys are done? Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep working on my steak here slowly.
No, totally. Well, like this is going to be very counterintuitive, but like I only learned this in like when I was 39 and, you know, and then kept it all the way through. But
I'm on that same boat. That's where I'm at right now.
What's that?
I'm 39 working on that right now.
Oh, no, you'd be surprised. So like instead of eating nothing or only 3 meals a day or 2 meals a day, you actually eat 6 meals a day.
I've had friends do like the IF stuff, you know, the intermittent fasting. I mean, like there's that new thing that's going on too with a lot of people like Kevin Smith, you know, like Jane Silent Bob, he does that intermittent fasting and whatnot. I haven't tried it yet though, but I think that might slow my metabolism down or something.
You know,
that I've read.
I'm not a fan of it. Mm-hmm. Intermittent fasting. And I've tried it, you know, what I found was eating 6 meals a day, 5 to 6 meals a day, right? And you do them in precise portions. You literally take a food scale and you weigh out all your food specifically. Mm. It's tailored to the way you're looking to, you want to look. You know, you could rip it down really fast. You know, you can just maintain. There's different tricks to it. It's a matter of the number of portion, the amount of portions of protein and carbs and vegetables and
I think I might take you up on that whole weighing it down a little bit, just because, you know, I think that there's a huge thing of when I think something happened in the 90s that I always tell friends, it's like there's this thing that ruined American society. It was called the big gulp.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's these things. It's like bigger is better. You know, you go to like a fast food joint. You're like, would you like a Coke? Yes. Like, let me just get a medium. And then it looks like it's a super XL large. And you're like, what the hell is this?
Let me supersize it. No, American portions make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. The portion, if you look at the portions that we eat that are prescribed, like a 24 ounce steak, you're supposed to eat 4 to 5 ounces. So that's a serving for like, you know, 4 or 6 people. Depending on what you put, because you shouldn't go any more between more than 4 to 6 ounces, and just modulating the weight of your meat, whether it's steak or fish or chicken, mm-hmm. that makes a huge difference. Even like, you know, like for example, a lot of people say, oh, don't, I'm not going to eat carbs. You know, like we're Asian, we love rice.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. And I was, like, was going to say that.
No. And no. So like, I eat a lot of rice, I eat a lot of brown rice, but I weigh the rice out specifically proportioned to like how I'm, you know, if I'm preparing for a competition, mm-hmm. I'm just maintaining. I mean, if I'm looking to get really, really ripped for a competition, I will reduce my carb intake a lot. Now, of course, you become extremely irritable when you're like carb deprived, right? Like yeah. My wife will often like, you're like, hey, you're being too much of a prima donna. You need to eat a cookie or some bread, you know, like, oh. So there's a time for everything. Right. But yeah, that
we all deserve to be like Joe Pesci for a few minutes.
No, definitely.
So, yeah, I mean, like, it is an interesting training thing because I've been working on that here and there, especially during pandemic. A lot of people have tried these new types of, like, foods and, you know, these new, more home cooking. Yeah. I'm seeing a lot more of that. So, yeah, it's always interesting for a lot of people that, you know, like, how much intake you should be taking in because, seriously, we're not out hanging out with people at the bar or anything like that. It's like, yeah, I'm going to eat these chicken wings and the extra fries and what, and you forget how much weight a lot of people have put on while you're out and about versus not just chilling out at home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the part of the whole diet too, is like, you know, you're cooking your own meals, right? Like mm-hmm. a lot, when I'm really, really deep into training, I'm getting up 4 a.m. in the morning. I'm cooking my 6 meals. Like a lot of times when people are training, they'll cook their meals for a week, like 7 days out, and they'll freeze it or they'll put in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. I don't like doing that. It just, because it tastes horrible by the 6th day. It's already tough enough eating that way. And you're going to be like, you know, like.
I could probably do it for maybe 2 or 3 days in a row. And then it's like, okay, I would probably cook something else again after for another 2 or 3 days.
Well, like when you're in training, you're eating the same repetitious 6 meals.
Like Captain America eating that chicken, that broiled chicken.
Yeah, except it's grilled chicken, right? And you're doing that, but it literally makes a dramatic change in your appearance and your demeanor and the whole nine. You know, it's just, it's crazy. But you know, like when that happens, I'm cooking my meals in the morning, preparing it, sticking it in a Tupperware, packing it in a bag, and you know, I'm off I go, right? So I'll set my alarm clock on my phone so that every 2.5 hours is buzzing and I'm eating. You know, even when I'm not hungry. And then what's funny is that by that 4th or 5th day, your metabolism just kicks on.
And so you would say generally every 2.5 hours you want to be eating.
Yeah.
Just a small little portion of whatever that is.
It's not small. I mean, it's when you're talking about like 4 to 6 ounces of a protein, 3 to 4 ounces of a carb, you know, then 2 to 3 ounces of green vegetables, and that ranges up a little bit more. You know, it's a pretty good portion.
A little handful right there.
Yeah. So, okay. But you're eating it, and then by the time you're like at your like a lot of times when I'll tell people this diet, and they're like, oh my god, I couldn't even go to the. I was having a hard time eating my 4th meal or my 3rd meal in such a short period of time. I mean, but then what happens? Sometime in between there, it just kicks on, and all of a sudden you're really hungry, and you're like, you know, like you have to eat every 2 hours, and so then you're just seeing. Everything from your face to your, you know, like your abs start ripping out. Like I didn't, like when I was in my 20s, I'd have to flex my abs. And then by the time I was in my 40s, it was just like always there. I was like, you get up in the morning, you're like, oh my God.
Oh, they're here.
Yeah, and I'm like, hey, honey, you know.
So I missed you.
Yeah. But, and so like after that, after you got that, you know, you're like, okay, never mind. I can make my choice. I can look like how I want to look. Or I can, you know, do this. Now that doesn't mean that I don't eat desserts and stuff like that. You know, there's a time for all that too. And you know, you just don't do it that often, right? Mm-hmm. And then a trick that I learned from my coach when I would do bodybuilding shows is like you're gonna deplete down to the day of the show. But on the day of the show, you're eating like pancakes and syrup in the morning. You're eating like chocolate and peanut butter.
You get to have whatever you want.
No, it's not whatever you want. It's you're inducing, you're bringing in simple sugars into your body and your bloodstream, glycogen, that suddenly inflates your deflated muscles. And so, but of course, doing that, you get to eat like Reese's Pieces and raw peanut butter and like, you know, and pancakes and syrup. And so
that sounds really good.
It's crazy because like you get up on that stage and you just ripped and you like you're back up there. And so I learned that like, hey, if I'm gonna go to the beach and I know I'm gonna go out like to Hawaii or something, I'll deplete down and then, you know, eat pancakes in the morning, right? Uh-huh. I go out there on the beach with my wife and it's just like it's
yeah. Great.
You know, like it's like, oh, I'm your pool boy. But it's you know, especially when you're in your 40s and you're like, and people are coming up to you at the beach and asking you, you know, like, hey, who are you? And I'm like, I'm nobody.
Yeah. Nobody's special, but I look, yes, yeah. Nobody flexing.
It's like, why? You know, what's
oh, wow.
Kind of funny, you know.
I had a few bodybuilder friends that were, that actually have that same red flesh face when they say that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, not at all. I was like, I wasn't at the gym. I just woke up and had pancakes.
Yeah.
Switching to being you know, with all your as being an entrepreneur and being and getting this movie together, it's got to be an interesting thing during COVID. It's like I thought, because you know there's like a lot of film festivals that canceled and you know and going on. It must have been interesting because you're trying to re-enter the movie back into these other festivals, and I think we're just now finally getting a lift. I mean, literally just. But early this week, we got the stimulus passed. So I guess things are probably looking a little up to open up soon.
No, I hope so. I mean, I think things are going to come back with a vengeance when it comes to like, you know, movies and things like that. And I think like, I mean, one of the things that I discovered with this whole new venture, you know, making movies as a side hustle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it opened up all that. These...
I like that side hustle. Yes.
It opened up all of these connections to people in Hollywood. So like for example, going back to the day after Principal Photography, we finished shooting Sunday, November 6th, right? And on Monday, November 7th, I'm flying out to Saudi Arabia. And wow. I'm meeting all these other celebrities and actors and producers. And so then I start connecting up on a first name basis with like, you know, Benedict Wong, who's like, you know, on Dr. Strange, you know, the sidekick yes. Dr. Strange or Mads Mikkelsen.
I love Benedict Wong from the Marco Polo. He was the
Oh no, the dude is, he's so down to earth and like he calls him, he says, my real superpower is I'm a human squirrel because I can just eat. And it's just like, it's kind of, so I you know, it's like funny because like now you're communicating, hanging out and talking to these people. Mm-hmm. And like I have, and the funny thing, when I was in Saudi Arabia, I ran into, of all people, Steven Seagal, and I had a really funny Steven Seagal experience of all things, right?
Oh, I want to know now. I've heard so many interesting stories of that guy.
So I have pictures of all this stuff. So this guy, you know, he has a real bad reputation for being mean, mm-hmm. right? And kind of being, you know, really standoffish. And so, you know, you could feel it off coming off of him, right? And so because I was warned about this, and again, I'm like nobody. I'm just like here hanging out with all these celebrities and producers. I had a predisposition to be standoffish toward him. And I was like, didn't want to talk to him, didn't want to make eye contact. And so I'm hanging out with them at this convention in the green room. So this is what they call where they put all the celebrities and stuff. While they're going out to make their, you know, appearances or panels. And so I'm just hanging out with them for like 3 days, right? So inadvertently, while we're in the green room and just chilling where they have food services and stuff, we end up sitting at the same table. And I'm like, literally, I'm in Saudi Arabia. I'm trying to like log, I'm on my computer trying to get Comic-Con tickets for 2020, right? Mm-hmm. And Steven Seagal sits across the table from me and we start chatting. And, then he's like sizing me up and asking me like, do you work out? Do you know martial arts? And I'm like, no, I don't know martial arts. No. And then like,
lean down, bow my head down.
I'm not going to fall for this. We're talking. And then, you know, we're chatting. And then I'm there with this, with one of the other producers from the movie that we did, Trees of Peace. And it's a guy named Barry Levine. And his name was attached to like Hercules with The Rock and Oblivion with Tom Cruise.
Oh, okay.
And so Barry's sitting here with me and he goes, Brian's an American Ninja Warrior. And I'm like,
You're fucked. I'm just
kidding. And he's like, what's that? And we're talking and stuff like that. And I'm like explaining. And so I'm just like, I could tell he's just sizing me up. And so we start talking about guns and we start talking about, you know, something. And finally, I'm caught off guard and I kind of agree with him. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of funny. And I stick my hand out for a fist bump. And Steven Seagal leans in and just, bam, nails my hand.
Oh.
So I'm sitting here like this. And I saw it coming. So I tensed it. And I was like, oh. And I pretended like I wasn't hurt. I was like, and I started going, right? And Steven Seagal, like, and Barry, my buddy, he's out there with me.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking at this and he's like, did you just fist bump with Steven Seagal? Don't you know that those hands are lethal weapons? And then Steven Seagal.
I didn't die from them. Those lethal weapons touched my other fist. It goes without saying.
Well, Steven Seagal turns to Barry Pilkey. He goes, your friend here has lethal weapons of his own. And then he opens up to me. And I'm like, I don't know you. Like, why are you seriously? Like, who goes around hitting somebody? And I'm like, so then this guy starts like being very friendly with me afterward, mm-hmm. right? He gives me his personal cell phone number. I didn't realize this, and you could look this stuff up. So Steven Seagal, he became the ambassador to Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Yeah, he did. I remember hearing about that. He's been living out in Moscow for quite some time.
Yeah. And so he starts he gives me his card. He's like, invites me to Moscow. And he's mm-hmm. like, dude, if you ever come to Moscow, you know, I will hook you up. I will, you know, and he goes, he gives me his card, right? It says ambassador and he writes his cell phone number. And he's like, if you ever find yourself in Russia and you're in a Russian jail, you just call me. I'll get you out. Literally, these are his words. And I'm like,
I've heard stories.
Find myself in a Russian jail that I need to call you up to get me out, right?
You know, that sounds more of I hate to just kind of fantasize, but I'm gonna say it anyways. It's kind of one of those. It's like I'm gonna fuck you over so you can thank me.
Exactly.
You know, like why am I in a Russian jail? It's like, well, I just wanted to know that you were here, so I was gonna bail you out. Hi.
So like you know. Needless to say, we start communicating a little bit after that. You know, like I get back from Saudi, you know, mm-hmm. we're talking about stuff. He's calling me and I'm calling him. And again, just before the pandemic hit, but like, because this was still in November, like this was still like December 2019, January. And he finds I'm going to go back out to Spain. I'm flying out to Spain in February before the lockdown, February 2020. Mm-hmm. This man's like, hey, you're going to be in... you're going to be in Spain. You're just 3 hours flight away. Why don't you come up to Moscow and visit me? And I'm like, no, I'm okay. I'll catch you next time. I need to get in now. But it was just kind of funny to have those kind of experiences with these people that I grew up watching.
Mm-hmm.
And then now like I'm communicating and talking to them and hanging out with them and actually working on different projects, not with Steven Seagal, but mm-hmm. other people that I met within the industry. So you know, it's been an interesting ride, and we'll see how this first movie goes, and hopefully it does what we want it to do. And so far, you know, like it's led a way to create a platform to go into other things as the new.
It's a great way to network with lots of people. I mean, even during my years of like doing shows and plays and stuff like that, it's you meet a great family that you know of cast. That you can call your family. It's just because, you know, there's so many like shared little memories and stories, backstories and little blooper moments between everybody. I think that it really, you know, even after years later, you still remember works you guys did together. I think that's always what I've enjoyed about, you know, doing any type of project with people as an intellectual property, because it's that intellectual thought shared.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. I mean, the more memorable stuff that was, you know, that actually came of that all experience was like I connected up with another an animator, a guy named Jay Oliva. And if you look up the name Jay Oliva, you'll see that he was the director of like Batman Dark Knight, Crisis of Flashpoint. And he actually did a lot of the storyboarding work with Zack Snyder on Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. Worked on Deadpool, Guardians of the Galaxy, Wonder Woman, live action with the first one, not the last one that we just saw that was like terrible. But the first
Doctor Strange, Iron Man, Sorcerer Supreme. All those. I've watched all of those.
Exactly. Right. So here I'm meeting Jay, and then Jay and I clicked right away. Like, you know, we clicked immediately, and like, you know, we found a lot of similarities. And so like, we're working on a project right now. We're working on a couple different projects in what's called pre-production, right? Where you're still developing the scripts, but they're more along the lines of things that I like that are science fiction related, that kind of thing. I won't talk much about that now, right? But, you know, I want to give a good shout out to my fellow Filipino buddy, Jay, who actually has his first animated series coming out on Netflix. It's called Trece. And he did this, and it's about a Filipina, she's female, psychic detective who fights Filipino monsters, right? And it's a popular graphic novel from the Philippines, and he brought this to the animated screen. Mm. And so he had this great background in animation, and he started his own animation company, took the entrepreneurial route, and had a little has his own couple of projects going with like Netflix and other things. And then he and I connected up, and again, we had a lot of commonalities, and we started working on other projects together, and that I won't go into.
No.
hopefully these things do see the light of day, you know, and we get them out there. It was great, because like you just realized, looking up his name, you're like, wait, I watched this guy's stuff.
I've seen all his stuff. I'm a big, as you can tell in the background, I'm a big DC fan and collector. Yes. I'm still watching all this stuff that he does. It's like, oh wow, that's crazy. I'm not paying attention to all the things that everybody's doing behind the scenes.
No. He's a really cool guy, you know, real cool dude. And you know, like we were actually trying to put together a deal with another IP holder that we want to develop yesterday. Mm-hmm. So we've had it's great, because we've been in there's a term called writer's rooms in Hollywood, where, you know, the different writers who are developing the script are working with the producers. And I've had the privilege of being in those rooms developing IP that we're trying to bring, you know, to the light of day. it's 2020 was quite exciting for me, even though a lot of it was spent at home in front of a computer collaborating with these other creatives, as well as working on my, you know, my day job of other real estate projects, trying to stay in shape and just taking lots of bike rides with the family. I mean, for me, it was a lot of time to actually
be. I was going to ask how's the family coping with it? You guys, so you guys are doing a lot of bike riding in the area.
We've been doing a lot of local traveling. I mean, like my wife, it's just my wife and myself and my daughter, right? Just the three of us. And we regularly we'll travel out of the country on vacation. You know, we like to world travel. But of course, when you're locked down because no one wants to accept an American passport into the country, you know, we're all a bunch of COVID infected freaks, right?
No, we did it to ourselves. American passport, no good here.
Yeah, I know. No good here. It's crazy. We ended up just like finding all these amazing bike trails in the Bay Area, driving out to, you know, like spending more time in Tahoe you know, again, where I live, I live on a, you know, two acre site with a, you know, big home. And so it's like, I was fortunate not to have to be, you know, stuck at home and not be able to get out. It actually helped me to appreciate my surroundings more. Because a lot of times you just take it for granted. You're like, you know, there's the Bay Area has so much to offer. So it wasn't a bad experience. But, you know, like everyone else, I'm anxious to get back to globetrotting and like hobnobbing and doing all this other stuff.
You know, I actually wanted to ask you a couple of questions about Saudi Arabia. Because I was, you know, it's so funny because there's so much development going out there at this point. I was talking to a friend not too long ago because it came up on one of my feeds about Saudi Arabia. They were building this linear city. Have you heard about that? Mm-hmm. That was it Nemo or something like that? Nemo?
I don't know. I, I was in Dubai, and then I was in Riyadh. And Dubai, and like, so Dubai is its own little country, which I really didn't realize. I mean, I knew it, but I didn't really know it until I actually came in there. And Dubai is like the Las Vegas of the Middle East, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
it's crazy. However, like, Riyadh is the capital of Saudi Arabia, and they're trying to catch up to you know, like what Dubai is like, but it's just not the same, right? I mean, like, there's a lot of brand new development, but then there's also a lot of like it's a stark difference between all the brand new and then the old. And then a lot of the Islamic laws, they were still very like oppressive to women. I mean, again, that's kind of just from a Western standpoint, because I don't think anyone out there is Muslim. And then they're wearing the burqa, right? It you know, I don't mean to be offensive, but in Saudi Arabia, it was very different.
Yeah.
In Dubai, it was very different. And they're really in the same continent. You fly into Dubai, then you fly into Riyadh. And so I was in Riyadh, which is the capital of Saudi Arabia. And so they're trying to turn Saudi Arabia's Riyadh's capital into a destination or tourist hub.
Yeah.
But like, for example, like, there's no alcohol that you're allowed to have there. Whereas in Dubai, you know, you can get alcohol because it's a Muslim country. And so there's a few things that they still have kind of backward, right? Because they want to attract more Westerners, but they also, but there's still the fear of beheadings, right?
Yeah.
I was out there with here's another funny story. So I was out there with Jason Momoa's personal trainer, right? And he grew up there apparently as a kid. So he's telling me of his stories in Riyadh with the religious police, that if, you know, when it's time to pray, if they catch you not praying, your head could come off. So again, I'm just hearing this third person, but I'm like, wow, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah. It was kind of like the first time I heard, like, oh, you know, you can get seriously punished in Singapore if you litter.
You know? Well, you can get punished in spanked, which is kind of like crazy, right?
Yeah.
But there you can get stoned or you have your head cut off.
Yeah, there's these huge extremes of freedoms that, you know, we have here in America that we don't worry about.
Well, like, and you know, but the thing is that in Riyadh, there's a progressive movement. And so another funny story, when we were in Riyadh, so I'm here at this convention. There's a lot of Western celebrities there, right? And in fact, what it was the very first Saudi Arabian Comic-Con, right? That's where I was at.
Oh, wow.
And I wasn't there so much as a fanboy as much as I was there on business, but it was kind of like business and pleasure.
So it's here. Might as well enjoy.
Yeah, no, definitely.
That's cool, though. It's in Saudi Arabia, of all places, so this is kind of just throwing you off already.
Yeah, no, Saudi Arabia of all places. Now, I've for the last 7 years, I've been to San Diego International Comic-Con as a fan with my daughter and wife. We do the whole dress, you know, we do the whole cosplay routine, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then I'm out there in Saudi Arabia and I have certain expectations, and it's, you know, something's still off. I mean, there's a lot of progressive movement. But however, when we were there, we met these cool people, and they say, hey, you want to come to a party? Now, keep in mind, you can have your head cut off if you're caught drinking alcohol or doing, you know, drugs.
Yeah.
And so they're like, we're at this convention, we're kind of like hanging out with these other celebrities, and this rich, I don't know what they were, but you could tell they were wealthy Saudi Arabian family,
some type of royals.
Yeah, they're like, hey, you want to come to a party? And so you're out there with a bunch of so I'm out there with some one of the actors, Adrian Grenier from it was right on the tip of my tongue, HBO Entourage.
Oh
yeah. And so we're invited to this party, and so we're like, oh sure, okay. And then we get into these cars, they pick us up, and they're driving us out through the middle of the desert. And the funny thing is like, you're like wondering, oh my god, I think I made a mistake. I'm
driving through the middle of the desert.
And you get to this like amazing mansion of a house, right? I mean, like, it's like walled in. You get through the gates, and you know it's this palace, and you go into the basement, and it's like a speakeasy, and it's a it's a full-on party. Like all the women with their burqas off, you realize how beautiful these Saudi Arabian women are. During the day, you're looking at them and they're all covered up and you can't see most of them. And you're like, oh my God, they are partying.
Here
and,
the...
if they get caught, they can all get beheaded. Like these are the young crowds, right?
Uh-huh.
So it was crazy. It was like hot, cold, you know. It was like you get into Dubai and you're like, you're seeing one kind of lifestyle. You get into Riyadh and it's a very different lifestyle that's trying to become Western. And then you get in with the locals and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, these guys want to party like crazy. And now they've got American celebrities here. And this guy had like multiple exotic cars in his garage, and the basement was just like, was a nightclub. It was basically a nightclub, you know?
Whatever you got under in that basement, you got it all the way out in the middle of a desert under there. That speaks for itself.
Yeah. It was quite an experience. So, you come back and like, you know, I came back in like November of like 2019 before the pandemic from Saudi. And I'm like, that was the most weirdest experience hanging out with these celebrities, fist bumping with Steven Seagal.
And then having him. But you know, it's still got to be a little eerie. It's like, how did he know you were going to Spain?
No, I told him. I told him.
Oh, okay.
Because the thing is like after I met him in November, when I was out in Saudi, we exchanged numbers. He warmed up.
Okay.
So like I was regularly texting with him and talking to him. I mean, I kind of like cut off association with him because he has a really rough reputation.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Hollywood don't want to work with him, right? So I'm like, I mean, like, I'm not stupid. I mean, like, I'm like...
No. You know, from all the Joe Rogan podcasts and stuff I've listened to in the past, it's like, you know, how he's roughed some actors up and, you know, they've said that about him. That's kind of what, you know, and not even just to actors, but to the stuntmen and whatnot. I've heard, you know, and even for as another martial artist in the world of, you know, hearing things. Like, to a testament of Steven Seagal, you know, he is awesome at his, you know, proficiency of what he does. Character-wise towards other human beings, you know, it's you know, that's other people on how they might perceive him. I think it's just, yeah, it is one of those that it's hard to be somebody like him and then also have, you know, issues of like reaching out to regular people also. Cause you know, it's weird. Sometimes it's like, you know, like you have this different level of fame, but then it's like, it comes with the good and the bad. It's always been kind of a weird thing. Cause over the years, like when I talk to my friends about Steven Seagal and whatnot, like I loved his stuff growing up. I love Aikido for the things. But like,
I was a huge fan of Steven Seagal growing up.
Yeah, but then it's like when he did the old police thing and what, you know, all the other stuff, that started getting a little weird for me because, you know, it was just like, it was different character of him. And I think it's like, for me, it's like, I respect him as a martial artist. I don't know about everything else. It's just because it's, you hear other stuff and you're just kind of like, well, you know, being good and doing good is different.
Imagine by the time I met him, he was up in years. And so
yeah,
when you meet him in person, he's a massive.
No, he is a massive dude.
Oh, dude. He's a massive dude. And so I can imagine in his prime, he was intimidating to me. And I'm not intimidated real easily. But I was like, I could feel this vibe. And, you know, like he warmed up to me, thankfully. But he did it only after he punched my hand, a total stranger. You know, and this is the guy I looked up to. And, you know,
it's a level of asserting a dominance. I've heard in a lot of stories, it's like he asserts his dominance. And then once he knows that he's asserted that, then it's then we're cool, sort of. But I got to punch you in the chest first.
Right.
What? Well, why? You know,
thankfully, I mean, I didn't scream. I was like, ah, you know, I was able to.
Fake, no, no, figure. No. I think it's, yeah, there's that level of too. But you know what? You know, besides the whole Steven Seagal thing, I think that's really cool that you know, it's like there's a lot of people that are in Hollywood and you know, all levels of people that, you know, are willing to, you know, work with everybody as best as they can.
Yeah. No, it's cool. So we'll see what 2021 has yet to offer.
So besides that, you know, there's one thing I do talk about stocks and as a broker yourself. Have you been keeping up with all the little, you know, the silly trends of the stock market with the GameStop and the AMC stuff? Do you follow any of that stuff or just any thoughts?
I do. I mean, you know, like a lot of other Americans in 2020, I started investing real heavily in stocks. I did it with under the tutelage of my buddy who's a hedge fund manager. So like he taught me a lot, you know, those because when you, then the first few months of the shutdown, right? Like March, April, you know, you're at home and you're doing work, you're doing your day job, but like, you know, day trading opens at 6:30 a.m. and really and a lot could happen between 6:30 and 9 a.m. and 9:30. So like,
yeah,
I'd spend that time just hanging out, talking to them in front of my computer. Like what you can't see is I've got multiple screens here in my office at home. This is my home office in my library, right? So yeah. I'm sitting here, you know, listening to my buddy guide me through this. So I'm picking things up very fast. And so because of that, I started watching all these things like GameStop, and I still am. I'm not by any means an expert, and I'm still a novice at this. And if it wasn't for like the guidance of my buddy, I could have probably lost my shirt in a lot of things. But thankfully, it was good. And plus, the market rebounded tremendously. Like no one ever saw that coming.
Oh yeah, no. That was one of the things that I talk about regularly at my end of the month show with my boy Willie Chen, who is a photographer slash daytime trader now during this whole pandemic, and a lot of the other group of friends that we share a lot of our stock trading tips, because you know we're all about that stonks. it's just funny because
do you make money in GameStop? Did you pick up on that?
You know, I guess since I'm on air being recorded, so like I goofed around and I threw a little bit of a few dollars at it, and I ended up, you know, selling a few days ago, made 12% profit.
Nice.
You know, and it's one of those silly things that I was telling some friends. It's like we live in such an interesting age where you can do it on your phone in your bed at 6:30 in the morning when you wake up, not necessarily be on computers or something.
I mean, before I left this morning, I traded Tesla stock, you know, bought it and sold it off at a pretty substantial profit. But you know, like I'm buying like 500 or 1,000 shares at a time and waiting and unloading.
Yeah, well, you do have to have those diamond hands, but it's really a long-term investment. You're not doing these like I'm just holding on today or for this week or something. A lot, there's a huge misconception about people that play that I've mentioned many times. I am not a financial advisor, so don't take advice from me. That kind of thing.
No, by no means take any advice from me. Don't.
No, but it's really fun to watch because it's I think the most interesting thing nowadays is that the internet is so great that you have Reddit people, you know, full of other random things that you have these guys making these straight memes left and right.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of the Elon Musk meme trolling everybody. Because, you know, like, you know, like the stock market, I've cracked many jokes about. It's like, I do miss Trump a little bit because, you know, he would say something stupid and the market would go stupid crazy.
Yeah,
And that doesn't happen anymore. No. You know, those were great days to buy stuff because, you know, like everything would tank and then you're like, oh, cool, I'm going to buy something because Trump said something stupid. But now it's kind of like, okay, the market's just kind of doing its thing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely crazy times. Well, crazy times, good times, I don't know.
well, that's kind of the funny thing about I find about stocks sometimes, just because it's like how certain celebrities nowadays, you know, you can tweet out something silly and then all of a sudden, oh shit, here goes a stock. Because like for a good minute, like Elon Musk got in trouble for the Dogecoin and the Bitcoin. He just cracked the other day or yesterday. It was like, Bitcoin's an anagram for the boring company. And so that was his company. He was hoping his stocks would go up, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I love his shit. I'm not going to lie. I have a few friends that hate on him, and I'm like, you can't stop a guy from trying to create things.
No.
It's like, that's the only thing you can't hate on him for that. He's just creating things. You can hate him on his personal life. That's fine. But
yeah,
you can't stop a guy for an entrepreneur for like creating something. Cause that's just, you know, that's stopping progress.
No, definitely.
Were you able to do any other projects throughout the year besides working on the film project here and, you know, just keeping up with like, you know, health?
Well, I mean, I'm developing two ground up brand new construction projects, and I got a 54 unit apartment complex approved for development in February of 2020 that I'm hoping to break ground on this year in El Cerrito. So it's an apartment building. That's my day job, right? Uh-huh. And you'll like this. And I don't want to jinx myself, but so you've been to my building. It's a 21,000 square foot building built in 1984, owned it for 20 years. And I was looking to redevelop it, you know, improve it. And so I have a huge lot in the back. And so I recently submitted these plans back in November with my architect to add on another 17,000 square feet of office, rooftop, you know, garden office, and then a 29 unit apartment building next door. So it's going to become a more modern structure, you know, kind of refacing the front a little bit, remodeling the lobby, but adding a big 17,000 square foot new structure for office space, bank, and all this kind of stuff. And then an apartment complex next door, because that's my thing.
That's great development in the area.
Yeah, it's a beautiful project. I mean, the great thing about it that's like I've had a lot of fun with is that now when you're working with your architect on Zoom and, you know, your developer, and you're running the numbers just to make sure that it's still going to be profitable, and, you know, you're running your expenses while he's designing this beautiful thing that meets the mathematical algorithms of your analysis, right? And to see it act, you know, your to actually work on that with someone and then present it to the community and you know, to know it's going to actually not only improve the community but also your pocketbook, right?
Yeah, you're looking at the budget to resource ratio of like, this is how much it's going to take and we can design it with this amount, and you're like, cool. this is going to work out.
So we submitted that in November. City really liked it. And then we just had our first public hearing on it last week. And the public, because, you know, in California, you can't just go design something and build it. You need to show it to your neighbors within 1,000 feet. And in this case, they made me go 3,000 feet out. And we did a Zoom meeting, right? So all the people in the neighborhood come in. And thankfully, I mean, Panola's a much more conservative and, you know, smaller town. So the neighbors came out. There wasn't a lot, but everybody pretty much loved the idea and approved it. And so now the city is really excited to see this thing go up. And so they're trying to fast track the approval process for me. And we'll see how that goes. But that's the one that I'm real excited about, because it brings something new to the community, kind of helps me to get my, you know, to get another foot up to help redevelop Pinole and see how that goes.
Yeah. In the North Bay in itself, I mean, like, there's still a lot of area that is still development all the way out to Hercules. And I'm not too sure about Rodeo or was it Crockett in that area? I don't know how much more development is out in that area, but I know, you know, there, because the Bay Area is, you know, like, for all those, you know, fans that are listening, it's like, Bay Area is pretty dense from like San Francisco all the way down to Fremont. It is like, you know, good luck trying to build a lot of things. There's not a lot of space. Something's got to go in order for you to build something more.
Right. Well, like my project in El Cerrito, it's funny. I have to demolish an office building that's there. And the funny thing is, when I started my own company back in 1998, my first office that I rented and ran my own little company out of was this building that I now own in El Cerrito that I rented from back in 1998. I bought it and closed escrow like in 2019. And then now I'm going to demolish it and build this new apartment building there.
That's going to be great. Because, I mean, like, a lot of people are going to need it in this upcoming year.
The one of the funny serendipitous things is, like, one of my clients that I met in this building that I'm about to demolish and build a new apartment building. I met this one client of mine. He's still he was actually my client for a couple more years after that. He actually came to work with me. So he's been working with me now for 20 years. God. His daughter, I met her when she was like 4 or 5 at this building in 1998. And so now fast forward to 2021, and she's like a 27-year-old grown woman. we're talking about doing like advertising and stuff. She's trying to give me a pitch for like promoting social media aspects on different projects I'm working on. So it's like, oh my gosh, this is so funny. You know, she's trying to get communications. And so her dad still works with me. And so, you know, her and her brother, they're grown with kids, and we're pitching ideas back and forth for advertising. So I was like, yeah, it's funny. This is one of the projects I'm working on. And this is where I met you, like, back in 1998.
Now flash forward.
Yeah.
So this project will probably carry on sometime later this year, maybe next year. Hopefully,
I am hoping to break ground on this project this year. I mean, ideally, we are ready to break ground in May, but according to my architect, you know, like there's a lot of bureaucracy when you develop. And even though your project is approved for the design of what's going to go there, the city has to go through different inspections and permits, especially like when you're going to demolish an existing structure. Like nowadays, you can't just go demolish things. We have to go in.
Yeah. Make sure there's no asbestos. I'm sorry. I just really wish you can.
Yeah. We actually have to take apart certain parts of the building that can be recycled and recycle them to where they're supposed to go. I mean, these are all things we should be doing, but it is so much more difficult doing it this way, right? And so it takes longer. So, you know, maybe we might break ground according to him, depending on the permitting system, because all these cities have been slowed down, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, they're not as fast because they're working part-time from home, part-time in the office. So it might be September. And I'm like, oh God, it's like, seems so far away. So you break ground, you demolish, you build this new structure that's going to go there. These things typically take 18 to 24 months to build, right? And I'm actually looking at a different style of building that I've this time around that I've not used before, but it's a popular new way of doing things. What's called modular, where the architect is designing this thing so it could be built ground up, but it's designed in such a way where large components of this thing can be built in a factory.
Okay.
And not prefab, they build components and then they truck it out and then they start lowering it like a big Tetris puzzle into place, and it cuts down your build time, like what would take 18 to 24 months into like 3 to 6 months. So in fact, if you drive up and down El Cerrito on San Pablo Avenue, you'll see one going up by the Del Norte BART station. It just went up really quick. They built the concrete podium, and then they started putting down all the levels, the second floor, the third floor.
Oh, okay. And then, you know, so that's considered modular. Okay.
Yeah, and then they start tying it together, and it's you know, just makes it that much faster. It's an exciting new way that they build things, and I'm like really, really looking forward to it. I mean, it's something I'm planning. It's a build design that I want to use on my own building, because keep in mind, and you've been in my building, like I operate my business out of there. I've got like 11 other paying tenants, you know, dentists, financial advisors, doctors working in my building as tenants of mine. And it's like, I don't want to disrupt their business, you know? And so thankfully the way that my land is laid out, I could actually start building this without disrupting anything, except for that, you know, you can't help but hear noise when you're doing construction. So I want to get this thing built as quickly as possible, as opposed to taking like 24 months to go design something and build, I mean, like to build something from the ground up in the traditional way that we normally do things. So,
okay. Wow.
A lot of exciting stuff.
All right, Atomic Zero fans, thanks for listening again. As we wrap up the show, I wanted to kind of talk about a couple of things that have been on my mind. Once again, this week has been a crazy week for Asian Americans on my dislike list. Once again, it's very disturbing how much stuff that you can find on like social media, you know, especially through all these Asian forums that, you know, if you're a part of any of them, they just kind of pop up on your feed. Recently, there was this one that's on the news that just happened the other day where over the weekend, there were these three girls that got in an Uber vehicle. I don't know if you heard about this, Brian.
No, it's the first time hearing about it.
It was on CBS. They just kind of brought that up. So a Asian Uber driver was in the car and these three girls got in and like one of them refused to wear a mask. And, you know, you're an Uber driver. It's like, well, you know, follow the rules. You're in my car, wear a mask.
Yeah.
So these two girls proceeded to take off their mask. And one of the girls even decided to reach up and grab the Uber driver's phone and cough at him, saying like, "Ooh, I got Corona." And, you know, called him a bunch of racial slurs and just kind of, you know, belittled him. And you kind of watch this on the YouTube video. And this is kind of through all the Asian Don on Facebook or the, you know, Asians with attitudes. You kind of see all these kind of pop up on the social media feeds.
Yeah.
And if not, I'll send that to you later too.
Wow.
It's just disturbing because, you know, the one of the girls even proceeds to rip off the driver's mask and then throw it at him. So apparently that's
crazy.
This is just like over the weekend. And
this was here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, here in the Bay Area.
Wow.
And they called him a bunch of slurs and they were saying that like, "Oh my God, I can't believe you're trying to kick us out in the middle of the freeway," but he pulled over or something, "get out of my car." Mm-hmm. And even on top of that, one of the other girls later on went on her own Facebook or Instagram, TikTok kind of thing and made another rant saying that she was sorry, not sorry kind of thing. And you know, it's like, "My boyfriend," one of the lines I heard was, "My boyfriend told me if anybody ever said anything, I'd slap that dude." You know, you just like, you need to slap, you know, you got to slap them and stuff like that. I'm sitting here going like, "Oh my God, this is so intelligent." And, you know, once again, it's very, it's disturbing towards Asian American communities lately because we're sitting around, you know, upset at, you know, things that we can't do. And, you know, this is one of the things that I dislike because I hate seeing this on my newsfeed. You know, I wish, you know, there were more awareness and, you know, lately we've been hearing about it. You know, Joe Biden said he's going to probably brush up and talk about, you know, the Asian hate crimes, you know, that we need to stop dealing with all, you know, with Asian Americans being hated on from the community. But it's really sad when, you know, like people are poor and there's a lot of strife in between right now. I don't know. That's one of my major dislikes. I don't know if you've had any Asian hate crimes that have happened to you or around friends or if you've noticed anything in your...
No, fortunately, I have not seen any of that at all. And I hear about it on the news and like I've said, I've got a lot of friends from all over the world and a lot of them have like, you know, emailed or texted or Zoomed with me just checking in on our well-being and if we're experiencing any of these things. And fortunately, no, we haven't. But I do see it, I see it on YouTube, I see it in different clips and it infuriates me, you know? I mean, I find it extremely infuriating. I mean, I wasn't born in this country, so I came over, I had the whole immigrant experience. I'm not even first generation, I am an immigrant, right? And I mean, there's so many amazing things about this country that, you know, set us apart from other countries in the rest of the world. And, you know, I travel a lot, so I can compare. But, you know, and like even here in the Bay Area, right? I mean, you know, we're pretty very fortunate to be such a huge melting pot that when you see this kind of stuff happening here, the fact that it happens here in the Bay Area in San Francisco is kind of more of a shock, right? I mean, like, I grew up listening to NWA, hanging out with, you know, two of my friends who are white and they're like, General Lee looking, you know, Charger, just like from the Dukes of Hazzard. But we hung out with, you know, our friends who were Mexican and black in the same Charger car, and we all got along. You know, it was a very different thing experience for me, kind of growing up. But then to see all that kind of stuff happening, it's right in your face. It's like two steps back, and then to have it directed at the Asian, you know, community is nuts. I mean, like, I'm seeing now all the celebrity step up, the Asian celebrities talking against what's been going on, and hopefully it'll stop, you know, because it's not cool.
No, and I think, and you know, I've talked about it many times on my show. It's like, it's always the most vulnerable. I've actually am very pleased to see how, you know, a lot of our youth and the younger generation, like the Asians with attitudes, they're patrolling Oakland Chinatown, and they're patrolling San Francisco Chinatown. And it's nice to see the, you know, community thrive back that way, because it's, you know, after the last year of just terrible atrocity that's happened in the community, it's like, you know, the two non-Chinese New Year's that didn't really happen. And yeah, it's like, I remember, one of my weird dislikes, I guess, from the year I didn't say that. It was like, I remember, like, watching a rerun of the Chinese New Year parade on TV, this year. I was like, what was that all about? and I'm a kid that, you know, I grew up doing, you know, martial arts and whatnot, and doing also, like, the Chinese lion dance and stuff like that. So it was really harsh this year to not be able to see a lot of my brethrens that, you know, do the Southern style lions versus the Northern lions. Those are different, but it's another form of camaraderie, but it's like, you know, during the new year, you do get with, you know, regular friends and family, and you celebrate with them. And it's hard, because it's like a lot of, like, holidays aren't, you know, no one's seeing that, but that's one of those. You have a dislike?
You mean from the past, what we experienced last
year? Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, there was a lot of good that came of last year, but I mean, there's no secret. There was a lot of bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, what a huge negative experience that I had was when we had just reopened, right? In June, just before June 1st. And it was like this like huge culmination of crisis. I remember, like, a lot of, so my building that you've been to, a lot of my tenants, the retailers, they were all shut down. The hair salon, the nail salon, the dentist, they were shut down. And, you know, like, here's these entrepreneurs, you know, trying to just get through. And finally, they're reopening, right? Where, you know, we're going to try to reopen. And then, you know, the whole explosion of the Black Lives Matter protest came out. Now, I completely understand, and I'm for what a lot of that stands for. But as you probably know, and if you look back during that period of time, there were a lot of instigators that would infiltrate these Black Lives Matter protests, and we don't know if it was Antifa, and we don't know if it was white supremacists, right? But I literally got calls from friends of mine from Arkansas and Tennessee, and so you're going to laugh, but these are white people checking up on me who are my friends, going, hey, it's not the blacks causing the riots, it's the white guys. I'm like, what? What? You know, and I get it.
If you watch some of the videos, it's all colors of people.
It's all colors.
It's like, it's silly to, like, point out from one camera lens that's focused on one thing sometimes.
Well, you know, a reoccurring thing that kept happening was, you know, they would say, okay, it would be either Antifa or white supremacists, you know, supposedly instigating. They'd come in and, you know, the riot started, it was a free for all. You have, you know, Filipinos, Mexicans, Chinese, blacks, you know, whites, all just looting Target, right? Like, there's an iconic scene of a white kid running out of a Target, you know, who's looting Legos, right?
Yeah. Like,
of all the things to take, you know, when you're going to, you know, I'm going to go get my Legos. But anyways, I mean, aside from, you know, because everyone was sort of participating in these riots, but you'd have these instigators. So me and my friends in the neighborhood, you know, like, this is like, and this is a, you know, this is of every race. We're tracking these things happening. And one of the guys in my building, he runs a chiropractic service. He's a Chinese guy. Cool dude. And we're comparing notes. Like, so a friend of mine sent me this clip that was literally, it looked like he was recruiting white people, offering to pay the money to throw bricks at white businesses and blame it on Black Lives Matter. And he had his, he had the similar type of like memo from his friend from Fresno, who's white, who got this memo from somebody trying to, and now his buddy was the head nurse at the CDC. And so we're comparing notes. It's a Filipino and a Chinese guy comparing notes that they're getting from their friends who are white to beware about, you know, these protests. And you know, if you recall during that time, like there was a lot of, and we saw it, it wasn't even theoretical, like Vallejo, Target got burned, right? The Emeryville Best Buy got burned. It's just closing in our little town of Hercules and Pinole. So I got wind that there was a Black Lives Matter protest happening at the Fernandez Park, like walking like 5 minute walk, 10 minute walk from where my office is.
Yeah.
So I'm like panicking. And I you know, like if you remember, like a lot of businesses they boarded up their places.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to mention it
on my podcast during when that happened. I actually, the shop that I worked at, we had to board up our shop.
Yeah.
I talked to them. Yeah.
So I took it a step further. I had my guys like create a barricade around my building so that, you know, like my retailers could still operate. They could open their doors. It wasn't shut. But the moment, like if something happened, they could close the door and it would create at least some level of protective barricade.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, not everybody's going to hop a fence.
No.
You know? But, you know, you still might get a few, but I'd rather bank on the small 10% or 20% chance versus 100% chance of somebody taking everything from me.
Well, and the funny thing is so we locked up and now on that day, there was a Black Lives Matter protest scheduled for a Thursday. And, you know, I was and buddies of mine from the Richmond PD, they were responding to similar threats that they were going to burn down somebody was either white supremacist or Antifa. We didn't know.
Yeah,
we're gonna burn down the Richmond PD. So it's just closing in our little town. So I'm like, oh my gosh, and I'd heard that like Hercules or Pinole might be a target. Now by the time this happened, a lot of the authorities caught wind of what was happening. So they, you know, they kind of like protected a lot of these cities. And by the time it hit our town, nothing happened. But the paranoia of watching these fires being set at like Best Buys and Targets slowly closing in, coupled with like the Asian, you know, violence.
Yeah.
They're like, this is the weirdest 2020 ever.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, that was something that I definitely disliked during that period, you know, but thankfully we got through it all. I was able to take the barricades down off the building, and you know, all the tenants and the people were pretty happy with them. I mean, like, because they were able to operate businesses, but they had some level of protection where they can close the door behind them. It was this wooden barricade, and closed the entire like perimeter of the building. And my wife was mad because she's like, "You just spent all that extra money to do that. Like, what if like nothing happens?" And I was like, What if something does happen?
well, that was, you know, the funniest thing. I remember when I first, like one of my earlier podcasts, when I first started, I forgot which podcast it was. It was like one of the first earlier podcasts. I was getting ready for the show here and, you know, in the area, like, it was like right before the lock. No, it's like the week right during the lockdown. They said, everybody needs to stay inside. Someone decides to break into one of my cars.
Oh, wow.
In front of my house. And I was like, what the hell? And, you know, the police officers, you know, that I'm just so fortunate to work on their cars. They come knocking on my door going, "Hey, James, your day off, huh?" "Yeah." "You know this guy?" "No." I was like, okay. And it's just one of those. They literally, my neighbor had called in, you know, good thing I have a lucky, you know, wonderful, you know, neighborhood watch because all my neighbors are, you know, going.
Where do you live?
Not too far from where your office is, to be honest.
Okay.
not too far, but it's kind of funny because it's like, you know, I do really love the interesting neighborhood of how people are very, you know, close-knit, and you do kind of talk to all your neighbors around the area.
Yeah, no, fortunately we're a pretty, you know, small community, and we're close-knit, and you know, we know each other, but yeah. The fact that you would just kind of see that on the news and slowly closing in, it's like, you know.
Well, Well, yeah, but then there's a huge level of paranoia too, because you know there was so much destruction during we started in like the summer, got just there's just wave after wave of protests during the summer.
Yeah, there was, so, was a lot.
So yeah. when you said you know, it's like even when we got wind of it at my shop and stuff like that, they broke into the dealerships over in the area and stole a bunch of cars from them.
I remember that. If you remember Walnut Creek, there was a massive amount of looting there, but there was no Black Lives Matter protests.
Yeah, no, and that's where those little fractions were. Yeah. Those people were breaking off. That they were like, they realized instead of doing a protest, we just got to get a mob together and run off and try to do that stuff, because you couldn't stop a mob.
Well, check this out. They found depots of bricks, milk, and water and supplies. So like, it was an organized movement where you can go to a designated spot, pick up a couple of bricks into your backpack, milk for the tear gas so to get out of your eyes.
Yeah.
If that's what it was for. And then water so you wouldn't dehydrate as you're running around throwing bricks and setting fire to people's businesses.
How thoughtful. Yeah.
I was privy to getting some memos forwarded to me from friends warning me that this is the kind of stuff that's happening in their neighborhoods. There's something else organizing these riots, and it was not these Black Lives Matter protests. Like, they would start out as a peaceful protest. They'd use that as a cover to mm-hmm. start some, you know, rioting. And then of course once the rioting starts, anything peaceful goes away, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an excuse to like rob somebody else's business. That was crazy.
Well, there was a huge moment where like, you know, don't rob this place because it's Black business owned and whatnot. Yeah. There was a lot of that, you know, virtue, a lot of signaling of like, you know, don't break my place. I support the community. I've been here forever.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say what me, the Chinese and the Chinese doctor and the Korean dentist did mm-hmm. on the rooftop while we were.
Well, you know what? I think everybody knows, you know, to his own, you know, I think that's how you'd say, but I think it's like, it is really sad because there were so many businesses in the area that I've watched during this pandemic where they were struggling, like literally bobbing in and out of water, literally.
Yeah, they were struggling. Yeah. And they were, they had just gotten through those first 2-3 months. And, you know, so I took an effort with all my tenants. Mm-hmm. I would help them get EID loans and help them apply. Because a lot of it, like, people didn't know how to do that. So I'm like, okay,
that's one of the biggest issues during this whole pandemic, where lots of business owners, where older generations that have owned businesses, they don't know where to get this extra loan money or not.
I just took them to the site, walked them through, helped them apply. And a lot of them got some relief from that. It got them through for a few, you know, got them PPP loans. It was
scary for lots of friends. I remember talking to a few friends that didn't even know that they would, you know, qualify or whatnot for PPE and whatnot. And it's one of those, it's kind of like when, you know, you get fired from a job, it's like, well, you don't know if you're gonna get unemployment, but it's better to at least try it. At least it's better to say that you didn't get anything, right? Yeah. that is a huge dislike. I guess moving on from my dislike this week, I think it's kind of funny. In the news, it's been a little interesting thing. If any to those that know that I've been kind of watching about the whole New York thing with the Andrew Cuomo thing and the allegations that's going on with him. One of the big funny dislikes that I've wanted to bring up is pretty much about the news.
Yeah,
you know, during the whole pandemic, they painted, you know, Andrew Cuomo as a hero. As a hero.
Yeah. No, I was thinking that, you know, when I started seeing that, I was like, I thought he was a hero. Now all of a sudden the script just got flipped on him.
Yeah.
The allegations are just like complete polar opposite of what we saw him. And I'm like, I don't even know what to believe anymore. Right.
Exactly. And, you know, there was a moment where, you know, I guess he was just so bold that he thought, or some people are thinking that, oh, he could run for president in 4 years. he might run because of all the wonderful things that he, you know, it was the same thing like when 9/11 happened and Robert, you know, Giuliani, you know, was like, oh, he was painted as this big hero of New York at the time. And it's like, oh, he might run for president or whatnot afterwards. I was like, nah, yeah, no, no. But Andrew Cuomo, I think he believed he could. And I think that's what is kind of silly, because when I watched all the stuff on CNN with him and his brother and all that stuff, I just couldn't stop laughing because I was all like, this is such a fake on how powerful, corrupt people, like, dude, you're on fucking the air for, you guys are both being paid and you're brothers and you guys are talking to each other on the air on CNN, chilling, and people, and nobody finds anything wrong about this. It must be really hard with your nose. Your brother's asking you that question. It's like, mom would be so proud that, you know, everybody's paying to watch us talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah, no, that was definitely weird. I mean, I didn't know which one to believe, because, like, I didn't know much about Cuomo beforehand, so all I saw was like, wow, this guy's pretty cool. He seems to be heroic. And then just a few weeks ago, it's like, wham, the complete opposite, and you're just, I don't know what to believe anymore.
So for me, I guess the big dislike, it's about the news. It's how they paint this story so well that it's kind of hard. No one's backtracking at this point, and they just kind of look like they're all bailing out on ship, you know? And I think that my big dislike about this whole thing is just like, the news is losing ratings left and right, so there's nothing that they can do, because, you know, it's Biden's been quiet during this whole period, and, you know, he's doing a lot of policy writing things in the background, which is, you know, some Americans, I think, is kind of funny, you know, like, since, you know, Biden's in office, a lot of people aren't really watching the news anymore, so the news is kind of tanking, and then you kind of watch, you know, Cuomo kind of on the news a little bit. It's like, oh, yeah, we're just going to keep, you know, harking at this dude, and, you know, he's kind of done. He just needs to resign now. And then he goes, I'm not going to resign because the people voted me in. It's like, yeah, so it's just funny, because it's like, I think that, yeah, even if he continues, it's for me, it's like, well, you can't really run again. You've already kind of lost in favor and whatnot. So that's my other dislike about the news. It's just kind of, you see it in the news and no one's calling it out, and there's not really any good journalism that's going on at this moment, because you're just like, yeah, you guys were kissing and licking his boot earlier, and now you guys are like, oh, I don't, we're going to talk about fluffy animals and
there was no transition. It was good, now he's the bad guy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I hear you, man. Like, it, they were, there was no consistency, and I don't know, and you're just confused. which one do you believe, the hero story or the monster story? It's
I like the monster story more, because, you know, the hero story made me throw up in my mouth a little bit.
Oh, so did you know he wasn't the way they portrayed him? Did you know,
were
you,
I always had a feeling, because I always had a feeling, and it was just mainly because of his brother on CNN. I'm not a big fan of him. And just how, you know, it kind of goes back to that whole, you know, Steven Seagal. Like, some people kind of know how you are, you know, your attitude. And when someone else is recording you from a phone and people see that you're attacking them, like, you don't know who I am, right? You know, it's like, oh, you're his younger brother got called, his name's on the tip of my tongue. The guy from the Godfather, the brother that gets shot up. I forget his name now. they called
the guy on CNN was called the guy from the Godfather.
The brother that got shot up. You know, the one that I forgot what his name was, but they called him that name, and he got so mad and infuriated, and, you know, he saw his gills. I guess that's what it was.
Wow.
So, you know, to me, it's just kind of like, it's a whole facade, and you know, there was another person I watched on The Hill Rising. It was a Korean House senator or representative from New York, who Andrew Cuomo was attacking him left and right, you know, because he was just asking about what happened in the hospitals and was inquiring about everything. I don't know if you saw that. I forget what his name was, but I'll remember it sooner or later. He was on the Hill like earlier last week or two, and they brought him on talk as you know, they were making all these claims about, you know, Andrew Cuomo and, you know, him questioning him. about what was going on. So it's just one of those things that I kind of had to bite the tongue on, because it's like, yeah, there's just so much wrong with the governor nowadays, kind of leading me into the same thing about mother dislike with the Gavin Newsom thing. A little big of a worry. There's 2 million people that have already signed the petition. They only needed 1.5 million.
You mean to like recall Gavin him? Newsom?
Yeah, that's going on at the end of next week.
Yeah, it's like you don't know what to believe, right? Like one side. So like crazy, you know, true story. I was actually met Newsom in person at one of my clients' homes in San Francisco. It's one of my clients. He's like big multimillionaire, lives up in Russian Hills in this like fabulous home. And, you know, he has Newsom there doing a political fundraiser. This was like about 3 years ago. So I met him in person. Gavin Newsom is a very charismatic, dynamic speaker, if anything. And so you kind of have like this great appeal, you know, to him. And then now all of a sudden these different things that have happened, he has lost favor with the public and now he's getting recalled. So it's really, you know, like that old saying, if you live long enough to have your heroes become the villains, right? Like,
oh, you're doing a Two-Face thing. Yeah. Oh, that's actually what I think of him sometimes.
Yeah. I was like, because I met the guy in person and he has a great charisma about him. I mean, great speech.
He's got that shining knight look, you know, about him. But, you know, the thing about it is for me, and I don't know him or anything like that, but, you know, when you hear his voice, he just sounds like a chain smoker. He's got this very deep, raspy voice. Like, I know when no one's around, he's just constantly chain smoking in the back doors. That's what I'm thinking he's doing. And that's kind of why I think he has this two-face, you know, personality. Like, he's a shining knight, and then whatever happens in the back door, we don't talk about.
I didn't even think of the comparison of Harvey Dent until you made
When
that.
You said that, I was like, oh, shit, I think so. I think that's a Harvey Dent thing. But I want to believe that he's a Bruce Wayne.
You know, when you meet him in person the first time, you get this impression like you could be a Bruce Wayne. You totally could be a Bruce Wayne, you know.
But he could also be quickly a Harvey Dent, because that's the parallels.
Yeah, but now all of a sudden he's lost favor, and I've heard that, like, you know, recall Gavin Newsom, recall, you know. So it's just very turbulent times. I feel like we're living in a movie half this time. You know, 2020 was like kind of felt like living in a movie. I mean, but, you know.
I was talking to a person not too long ago. We were just kind of brushing over the stuff of 2020. And I guess I was telling him, I'm like, well, you know, we can eliminate the protests. We can eliminate, you know, hate crimes. We can eliminate all the killings. How about we just talk about Mother Nature trying to kill us? That alone is more, and I'm not like, let's not talk about that pandemic. I'm just talking about basic stuff like, you know, what, like America went through like 3 or 4 tornadoes.
Yeah.
A freezing, a fire, I don't know, a dust storm. Well, birds, you know, flying random places.
This is the year that the aliens are supposed to reveal their presence to us. So, you know, we'll see.
Oh, no, I've said this before on this podcast. My biggest disappointment of the Trump administration was, damn it, I fucking thought he was going to tell us about the aliens. I swear to God, I was on like, dude, when they talked like a couple years, I think it was a year or two ago, when people were talking about storming Area 51, I don't know if you remember that. I was literally hoping that it's like, fuck it, you don't need to. Trump's just going to unveil, you know, the red curtain and tell us what the aliens look like. You know, they've been here all along.
Yeah,
I've been waiting for that shit. But
I love that old CNN video where they released the pill, the Tic Tac UFO, the jet fighter thing.
Yeah. That whizzes off real quickly, and you're like, "What the hell's that?"
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought that was pretty cool, but you know, we'll see what is yet to come.
Things that you like. Did you want to take us off that with something you liked of the last year?
Well, you know, like I've said, I got a lot of stuff done. You know, I networked with some of the people that I watch on TV and movies, and I'm working on projects with them. So it's great while I'm advancing the stuff that I typically like. I mean, I had a lot more time to spend with the family, and that was good. We got a lot of, you know, we're together in the home, you know, we're not traveling. I'm not traveling because I travel a lot on business. And, you know, a lot of bike rides together, a lot of hanging out. And really just appreciating what a great life I have in the Bay Area, you know. So just going down to the waterfront from where I live, or seeing the view and actually exploring that with my family and my daughter, that was probably some stuff that, you know, I live a pretty busy life, pretty, you know, I travel a lot on pleasure and on business, but mainly business. And so I'm gone a lot. But I got a chance to really enjoy the home I'm in, you know, that I've been in for 20 years, and just the surrounding neighborhoods, and do that with my wife and daughter. So, but like, my wife and I would be, what's that?
You do miss traveling on the plane a little bit, right?
I miss traveling on the plane a lot. Yeah. I mean, like, I was in like probably six or seven different countries in 2019. Hmm. And then in January of 2020, I was in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Spain. And then in Beverly Hills the week before the shutdown in March. So it was like all that condensed in, and all of a sudden I come back to my office and they're like, are they really shutting us down? And, you know, and it's like, we didn't even have to know. So I sent my people home, you know. Fortunately, I actually had Zoom set up for most of my office, including, you know, how I would do things, because I knew I would be doing so much traveling. So when the pandemic hit, it was like, okay, well, I guess we all switched to Zoom. And so we adapted really well, because we were using it a lot already. And once we adapted, it picked up the pace. We just couldn't travel. Like, there's one of my associates, this guy, he travels, like, I call him the traveling fool. The guy travels, and he works in my office, you know, sharp commercial broker. He's actually a professor. He's worked with me now for, I think, well, going on 10 years. And he travels all over, and he couldn't go. You know, he this guy's back and forth to Asia all the time, and Hong Kong and Vietnam, and we were stuck. We're grounded. So, but
I guess for me, one of the big legs is the in this last month that's passed, and I didn't get to mention this on my last podcast, you know, the we have a third vaccine, you know, the Johnson & Johnson's been approved. And I think, you know, collectively, as you know, as humans as a whole, there's no greater time in history to have seen mankind put together, you know, a bunch of shit together in like 11 months.
Yeah,
barely in a year, you know. It's like, because, you know, like last year in you know, March, April, and May, we didn't know shit. We were all watching the news going like, oh, can we get it in the air, or maybe I lice all the shit out of everything because anything I touch has COVID, but I don't even know what it is. So it's like, it's an invisible ghost.
Yeah.
And
I know, it was the uncertainty was crazy.
And now that it's like, you know, we got the Johnson & Johnson, and it's funny, like, how many other countries don't have a vaccine yet. And China has one, the Sinovac vaccine, or they have two.
I didn't hear about it. I thought we were all using the same one, but I guess that's news to me.
I was looking this up, but Pfizer is the one that's actually touched a good chunk of it. Because, you know, it's like in Germany and other parts of, like, but that's the most reaching one is Pfizer.
Hmm.
That's out of all the vaccines. But China, you would assume that they would give us the vaccine or share it with everybody else, but they're not. I don't know. That's another thing on its own. But yeah, no time in history that, you know, like, we were able to, like, have like three vaccines. And, you know, it's funny too, like, in the news how they're like, it doesn't matter which one you get, just get your shot. But, you know, I was telling some friends, and jokingly, I said this to them. They're like, because they asked me, like, which one are you going to get, James? I was like, I'm going to base it off of pure research. And they're like, well, which one's that? Simple. I'm just going to go with whoever's stock is highest.
Yeah.
That's how I usually base all my research. And they was like, really? I was all like, no, that's not true. Because Pfizer is the cheapest one out of the three. At $66 a share, I think it was. That's still a lot. I mean, it's not $160, but, you know.
Yeah.
Like Johnson & Johnson. But you know, either or. But it's funny, like if you really look about like where who actually has a vaccine or what countries have it, it's not a lot of people still have that. And I think a good chunk of the world, my friend sent me this link, and I was looking at it. It's like we might have the vaccine, but other parts of the world won't have the vaccine for at least another year or two before we make enough for everybody.
Wow.
Like the last continent that will catch up with anybody will be Africa and whatnot. It was like, it was painted colors of like who will ultimately come out of the pandemic and then, you know, whatnot. Obviously the first and third world countries will come out of the pandemic first and then, you know, the other remaining countries. But I mean, we only acknowledge 256 countries on this planet, so whatever.
Wow.
Random fun fact, right?
Hear about that. Where can you get that information? I haven't seen any of that.
I Googled it up after my friend had sent it to me, and I'm just trying to remember which link he had sent it to me under. I sent it to him the other day. I'm just trying to remember where it.
Sure.
It was on the. I'll find that link though, but and post it up on the next podcast for everybody.
Cool.
I guess I did miss one other dislike that I wanted to mention earlier. So from like over the weekend, there was the whole Meghan Markle and the Prince. Have you heard of that story?
I have. I haven't had a chance to follow it. And I guess there's a lot of like racial allegations and you know, like even questioning how dark the baby is and stuff like that. So
baby's not even out yet. Jesus.
But I guess racism is rife everywhere. It's rife everywhere.
You know, I guess for me, it's like I watched all these clips. You know who I'm most in awe from just watching it? Is as she's telling the story, I don't know whether it's true or not to believe her, Megan or not. But I think I'm just more fascinated at looking at Oprah the whole time.
Oh,
like
wow.
How she mingles with everybody. And like no one calls her out about the glasses she's wearing. You know, these white, you know, spectacles that she has on, like the white lenses.
Mm-hmm.
The frame, and I'm just sitting here like it's just Oprah being Oprah, like she's being bougie in my book, and I thought that was quite funny. The other thing that I was looking through the Twitter feed and stuff like that about Harry was like, can we bring back the soldier Harry? You know, like the one where he was like a great, the one, you know, the lovable guy, and then he just, Meghan's just done so much wrong to you. She's made you a different man. That's all the memes that I've been seeing.
Yeah.
Right. It's really funny because it's I don't know, you know, it's you know, my take on it, and I would tell my fans as I say this, it's like, you know who you were dating when you met him. You knew he was a prince. I'm not saying that the royal family isn't racist or not racist. There's obviously some type of history baggage that comes with that royal family.
You think? I mean, it's a long lineage of family.
Yeah, of a very Saxon type of family. You know, I'm not saying that there wasn't, you know, other cultures in beforehand. It's funny. It's like, I forgot someone said to me, it's like, you know, but Harry's like ninth on the list to becoming crown prince, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, that's a whole lot of people still that you gotta knock off. I'm sorry. I'm like, why does that matter? It's like, you know, that's one of the things that I like in this modern world that we live in. I think that's one of the big things I still can't get over. It's like, wait, how many seats are you away from the throne?
Yeah.
How many people you get to talk to like that? It's like, how many seats are you away from the throne again? Cool.
You're not getting it. Don't worry.
It's secure. Yeah, right. 19. So I was like, dude, Queen Elizabeth's been around for a good minute.
Yeah.
Good luck. You know, I'm a big chess guy. I love the jokes where it's like, you know, like no matter how we try to talk to the queen, she always moves in diagonals.
I didn't even see that one. That's funny.
That was on Twitter and I thought that shit was fucking. Yeah. I mean, there's so many queen memes all the time, but it's usually like the bishop standing there and her, and it's like, oh shit, she's about to get these knights. But yeah, those things you know, it's like, as you know what, for me, it's like, I don't care how racist the royal family is. The question is the queen racist? That's all that matters.
Right, but you never know. You never know.
Well, you know, I mean, Prince Charles, I don't know. He just doesn't come off as racist to me. He's got a whole lot of other problems going for himself racist. I don't know. And for me, it's just kind of silly. It's like, well, if Harry is ninth on the list, I'm just making talk here, but if Harry's ninth on the list, Meghan, what does it make you? Nowhere on that throne.
Right, nowhere on that throne. Not for a while. So I shouldn't even worry.
And it's funny, like, you guys ousted yourselves and you guys came back to America. Why does it fucking even matter? It's like, yeah. You know, you're so worried about that. It's like, you know, the only question is, it's like, well, hurry up and produce the kid. So at least the queen can still play with the kid before, you know, anything. But, you know, that's it. It's like, at least the kid will get closer to the throne than all of you guys by sitting on her lap.
Exactly.
Another like?
Another like of 2020?
We're up to 2021 now.
Up to 2021. Oh, well, I mean, this year's off to a great start. You know, like I said, like, got two approved real estate projects, or one approved. It's like moving along fast, and one that's very close to it. I got my, like I said, this first movie, Trees of Peace, premiering in April. So like, my wife and I are preparing to get out there to the Santa Barbara Film Festival. This is really our first one, right? So this is the whole frou-frou part of all the hard business planning and work that went into doing this thing. And so there's just a lot of, like, you know, good positive anticipation, right? So far so good. So far so good. And, you know, health is all still there somehow throughout all this, and didn't get any COVID. I'm just happy for a lot of things. So, you know.
All right, Brian, take us home.
All right. Well, hey, thank you all for joining us for another episode of Atomic Zero. Hopefully I was able to help and entertain and maybe inspire some of you guys out there, and catch us on the next show.